mystic crystal revelations and the mind's true liberation.
Are you going to sing?
Aquarius. Aquarius. Let the sun shine in. I had a couple of different ways of approaching this material that I want to cover in our last hour or so. And I have it all written out. But I gave you that paper I wrote for Psychological Perspectives that was published last fall. It's called Jung and I on Time, Vision, and a Wayfaring Man. And I said it as well as I could in that paper. So I'm going to... I want to just give you a little bit of a personal perspective about my journey with Jung, how I came to some of my views, and how I came to see some of those things in that paper. If you want the details, if you want the quotes, and if you want 3 pages of footnotes, you've got it. And if you don't have it, I'll send it to you. And if you're hearing my words, send me an email, and I can make sure you get a copy. Unfortunately, the journal Psychological Perspectives with that paper in it sold out in about 3 months, so it's not in print anymore. But you can actually find it from the publisher on the Internet. So let me tell you how I got involved with Jung. I had been somewhat disoriented throughout my late 20s and 30s about my relationship to philosophical, spiritual, and religious institutions, shall we say. And the only thing that made sense to me for many, many years, starting probably when I was about 27, about the time I was about to graduate from medical school onward, was climbing mountains. It's the only thing that attracted me. I simply had to do it. Something drew me there. I did not have reasons that I could define. It just seemed what needed to be done. And I mentioned in the first lecture that I climbed a mountain called K2 in 1986, and some unusual things happened. I had no idea why I went to K2, and I had no vision of where life went after that point. In fact, given the odds of not surviving climbing K2, I figured there was a good chance I didn't have to worry much about the future, and I was not particularly bothered by that. So I came home, and working as an ER doctor, one night I turned on the radio on my way home from work at 2 in the morning. And on one of these public radio stations in Los Angeles, there was a lecture playing, and the lecture was by a fellow by the name of Dr. Stefan Heller. And it was called Ego, Island of the Soul. And it was the first in a series of 7 lectures as an introduction to Jungian psychology. And I only had a 10-minute drive home. I just got in the car, and the lecture was just starting. And I got home, and it was one of those driveway moments where I sat there for an hour and 15 minutes and heard the rest of the lecture and thought, my God, this makes sense. And it was the first thing that had made sense to me in quite a while. So I assumed that whoever was giving the lecture was probably dead or far distant, but it ended up when I contacted the company that sent out these tapes, I waited to the end of the lecture to write down the information, that not only was he not dead, but he was very much alive, and he lived fairly close to me. And I had a little chapel and a lecture hall where he discussed things. So I went and I met Stefan. And it really was a major event in my life. Stefan is truly one of the most insightful individuals with regard to Jungian psychology that I've met, and at this point in life I've met a few. Stefan had been introduced to Jung in 1948 or 49. His family was Hungarian, actually Hungarian nobility, and after the war they had had to leave, due to the communist takeover, leave Hungary, and he was in Innsbruck. And he was training for the priesthood. He was considering entering seminary at that time. And he hung out with an old Jesuit priest there in Innsbruck. And they used to go to the reading room at the American Information Agency because it was the only place that had heat in the middle of winter in Innsbruck. And they'd sit there and read their papers and books. And there was a visiting priest coming from Switzerland who had a very strange book that he wanted to share. It was something that had been written by a fellow by the name of Jung, and it was called The Seven Sermons to the Dead. And Stefan was 19 years old. This was 19 or 18 years old. This was 1949. And this fellow, older priest, came, and he had one of the original printing copies of the Septem Sermones ad Mortuos that Jung had privately given to people throughout his life. And they sat there and read it. Stefan was so impressed that he begged this fellow to take this very rare and valuable and usually unseen document home, and he did. He was allowed to do so, and he sat up all night and he copied it verbatim and kept those notes, and he still has those notes now, 60-some years later. He went on to do the first English translation, privately printed, of the Seven Sermons, because these were unknown publicly, really distributed publicly, until after Jung's autobiography was published. In the first American edition of the autobiography, the Seven Sermons were not included. In the second, they were. And Stefan introduced me to Jung through the Seven Sermons. Jung had said that the Seven Sermons to the Dead provided a summary of all he had to say to the world. Stefan had taken that seriously, and so did I. Let me tell you how the Seven Sermons came to be. You'll remember that episode of Jung in the kitchen. He's been to the library, he goes to the kitchen, he has a book of Thomas A. Kempis. He's sitting there at the table in the kitchen and falls asleep, and then a horde of ghostly Anabaptists arrive. And the head of the clan is Ezekiel. And Jung asks him, well, what are you looking for? Because they're going to Jerusalem to visit the Holy Sepulchre. And Ezekiel looks at him with wild eyes and says, I don't know what we're looking for. And then he stares at Jung and says, do you know? And grabs Jung by the lapels and starts shaking him. And Jung is screaming. And the only thing he screams out at that point is, as you'll remember, you have not lived your animal. That was his answer. This had happened in early January of 1914. What I didn't maybe tell you before is the Anabaptist movement had been founded. The Anabaptist was sort of a radical splinter sect off of the early Protestant Reformation that felt the Reformation had not gone far enough. The Anabaptists felt that adults should accept baptism in adulthood, not as children. And the Anabaptists were much persecuted. They were persecuted by the Zwinglians. And Anabaptist means second baptism, essentially, that you have to be baptized again as an adult. Well, the Zwinglians, who ruled Zurich at that time, believed that all Anabaptists should have a third baptism. And the third baptism was tying them in a bag with a rock and throwing them in Lake Zurich. And there are a few plaques along Lake Zurich, right in downtown Zurich, commemorating the Anabaptists who had received a third baptism at the hands of Zwingli. So when the dead came to visit, the Anabaptist dead came to visit Jung, there were quite a few Anabaptist dead just a few feet beyond the edge of his yard in Lake Zurich. Okay, that's something. And also the Anabaptist movement had been founded in Zollerkahn, which is about 10 blocks from Jung's house in Kusnacht. Zollerkahn. So now it's 1916. The visions had begun again. After Jung had done the transcription of the black book material with this initial commentary layer I've spoken of many times in late 1914, early 1915, after the war had broken out, after he'd got a perception of what his vision was, of what it meant. He had started having visions again, and when did it happen? It happened in late summer, and then in the fall of 1915. And Philemon came back to him. This is when really Philemon became a figure of a guru and began speaking to him, teaching him. In the Red Book, there are some appendices. And one of them is a vision that Jung had, a conversation with his soul he had in January of 1916. And it is one of the most amazing conversations to speak about religion. In this conversation Jung has with his soul, or better stated, in this speech that his soul gives him, there is an entire ancient cosmology, a creation myth about the nature, not of world, but of consciousness itself, and of about what God is. But Jung was coming to summary conclusions about what his experience had brought him. One of the conclusions is that what was ancient does return again. He felt that some of the material that he was seeing had been shared across the ages by others, all the way back to ancient Christianity, to a sect called the Gnostics, who Jung described as early or proto-psychologists. These were people who had taken the imaginal as real and attempted to enter the visionary and record the events. Out of their experiences, there developed what might be called a psychology or a religion, which was heavily suppressed by orthodoxy in subsequent centuries and pretty much entirely eradicated by the 3rd and 4th century. Jung felt an intense relationship to these people. And he came to feel that Philemon had been an Alexandrian Gnostic, that his teacher had been an Alexandrian Gnostic. And so, on Sunday, the Jung family had dinner together. At 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and I believe the date was January 30th, the family was sitting there. His children had been having disturbing dreams in prior days, and Dr. Shamdasani gives a bit of a story about that, things that Jung told Carrie Baines, that Baines wrote down in her diary that Sonu put in the introductory material to the Red Book. You can read some of that there. The doorbell rang. It was an old doorbell that actually shook when you pulled the cord. You know, ring. It moved. And Jung went to the door. No one there. And then he tells the story in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. The front doorbell began ringing frantically, but there was no one in sight. I was sitting near the doorbell and not only heard it, but saw it move. We all simply stared at one another. The atmosphere was thick, believe me. Then I knew that something had to happen. The whole house was filled, as it were, with a crowd present, jammed full of spirits. They were packed deep right up to the door, and the air was so thick it was scarcely possible to breathe. As for myself, I was all aquiver with the question, "For God's sake, what in the world is this?" And then they cried out in chorus, "We have come back from Jerusalem, where we found not what we sought." And that is the beginning of the 7 sermons to the dead. Now, when Ezekiel had grabbed Jung by the collar in 1914 and asked him, "Do you know what we're seeking?" he really had a very brief answer. Good enough answer, but a very brief answer. Now, they had come back. And now, Jung had a much more complex, much more complete answer. The 7 sermons to the dead present a vast cosmogonic myth, a discourse on the progressive emanation and evolution of human consciousness from a first unconscious source, an ineffable, undifferentiated fullness Jung called the Pleroma, or Pleroma. Though he used terms common to ancient Gnostic mythology, such as Pleroma and Abraxas, a god name, this myth was not a recapitulation of any extant mythology. Although an incautious reader, unaware of its true provenance, could actually read it as an ancient Gnostic document. And in fact, when Jung first did his transcription of the Seven Sermons, which he did in 1916, not too long after he received them, he did not put his name on it. He attributed it, the text, to one Basilides, or Basilides, of Alexandria, a true Gnostic teacher in Alexandria of the second century. And then he put in a little subtext, transcribed from the original into German. It was a pseudepigraphic work. And then he put an anagram on the front page. You've all seen, if you've read the Seven Sermons, you see there's an anagram at the back. Well, for 60 years, no one knew what Jung's anagram said. What sort of occult knowledge had Jung put in his anagram, which is published at the end of the Seven Sermons? It's been deciphered now. And you know what it says? Written by C.G. Jung in 1916. Written by C.G. Jung in 1916. It wasn't any, it was his own joke. He actually attributed his authorship with the anagram on the title page, but hid it from everybody. Why he was doing this is unclear. But what is clear is the Seven Sermons were extremely important to him. He said, in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, "These conversations with the dead formed a kind of prelude to what I had to communicate to the world about the unconscious, a kind of pattern of order and interpretation of its general content." That's what he said at the end of his life in 1957. A prelude to what I had to communicate to the world. So, my introduction to Jung was a little bit strange in that this is the type of material that I was directed to examine closely. If one, prior to the Red Book's publication, were to closely read what Jung wrote in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, if one listens to what he said in the published version of the 1925 seminar he gave, which I've quoted to you several times over the course of these lectures, and if one looks closely at his footnotes and the undertext, the text sometimes hidden underneath the primary text of his collective works, it was clear that Jung had had an extraordinary visionary experience, and that his collected works, his life work, was an expression, an interpretation of that event. But that was a hard fact to get across to others who wished more to approach Jung as a theoretician, as a philosopher. And Jung perpetually, throughout his life, refused such labels. He hated to be thought of as a philosopher or a theoretician. He wasn't. What was he? He was a man who had known the psyche. He had met it, he had seen it, and what he emphasized is he was an empiricist, scientific empiricist, if you will. But there was an observation to which he was making comment, and that observation was an experience of the psyche. I can't talk about the Seven Sermons in detail. I won't try to, and I've been avoiding even beginning to talk about them because I knew it really is it would take many days to go through it. Read them yourself, and read them in the Red Book. Because in the Red Book, we find something that was not in the original published manuscript of the Seven Sermons. And let me explain that to you. When the Seven Sermons came to Jung, starting on January 30th, and it appears from Dr. Shamdasani's notes that Jung was actually working night by night to about the 8th of February. So it was about a week and a couple days. Jung was working on the writing of the Seven Sermons. When Jung first wrote the Seven Sermons to the Dead, he wrote them in his voice. The dead had addressed him. We have come back from Jerusalem where we found not what we sought. And Jung gave the answer. He was the voice. Okay? Then, this was in January of 1916. Later in 1916, he decided that he would publish this prelude to all he had to show the world. This was the only piece of the Red Book that Jung ever disclosed to the world. The only piece. He first did a beautiful handwritten calligraphic version with that anagram on it. And then he had it set in type and printed in German. He kept copies of that in his house all of his life. It wasn't a very large printing. I suspect probably only a few hundred copies. And from time to time, he gave them to people he thought appropriate, with the understanding that this was held in, it wasn't secret, but it was held in relative reserve, shall we say. In 1980, my friend Stefan Heller wrote a book, 1982 is published, called The Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead, in which he did an exegesis, an interpretation of Jung's psychology in terms of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, relating it to ancient Gnosticism and ancient Gnostic concepts. And through a friend, when the book was, it's been translated into 15 languages or so now, when a friend was visiting Zurich after the German translation was done, she took a copy and to Franz Jung, Jung's son. And Jung's son, after reading Stefan's book, wrote him a beautiful letter, which I've seen, thanking him for the book, saying that he thought he had precisely presented his father's, Franz's father, Carl Gustav Jung's, ideas, and included a gift in gratitude. And the gift was one of the original printed copies of Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead, which I've held in my hands many times over the years. So, when he printed that up, he attributed the text, as I said, to Basilides, or Basilides, of Alexandria. But then, when he finally transcribed the Seven Sermons into Liber Novus, he understood it was not he who had been talking, Jung. Jung had not been using his own voice. And it had not been Basilides' voice. It was Philemon who had been talking through him. You see, and this is the differentiation of his experience. These things were coming forth from him, but he did not own them as his creation. He understood that things deeper within him were expressing themselves. And this happens quite often in ancient texts. If you go back and look at early Christian documents, of which there are many that didn't make it to the Bible, these are often written in the voices of apostolic figures by others later on. It's not meant to be a fiction or a fraud. Sometimes people feel as if they are speaking with the voice of something deeper and other than themselves. Okay. Very common in the visionary tradition, the pseudepigraphic, false named, written in another's name type of work. Well, in the Seven Sermons to the Dead, as they appear in Liber Novus, it starts this way. And this is how Jung transcribed it. This is about 1918 when he transcribed Scrutinies, that last section of Liber Novus. Behold, Philemon came up to me, dressed in the white robe of a priest, and lay his hand on my shoulder. Then I said to the dark ones, "So speak, you dead." And immediately they cried in many voices, "We have come back from Jerusalem, where we did not find what we sought. We implore you to let us in. You have what we desire, not your blood, but your light." That is it. Then Philemon lifted his voice and taught them. So you see, it's not Jung, it's not Basilides, it's Philemon speaking through him. But then it gets even stranger, even weirder. On the very last page of Liber Novus, as you have it, Jung is walking in his garden. with Philemon. This is where he's walking in his garden with Philemon, okay? And they see a blue shade standing in the garden. It says blue shade in Liber Novus in his journal. It says Christ. They saw Christ in the garden. Philemon addresses Christ. My master, my beloved, my brother. Christ sees Philemon, but recognizes him to be Simon Magus. One of the first historical figures of ancient Gnosticism. Philemon explains to Christ that once he was Simon Magus, but now he is Philemon. So, consider that. Jung is the voice of the sermons in the first journal. In the Septum Sermonis transcribed in the Red Book, Philemon is the voice. Then he transcribes it for publication. He calls it Basilides, an ancient Gnostic teacher. Then it's revealed that Philemon is really Simon Magus, perhaps the initial figure in the foundation of ancient Gnosticism. So Philemon and Jung and Basilides and Simon Magus are all the voice of this visionary text. At this point in his journey, the sum of evidences suggests Jung associated something very central in his experience with an ancient nexus of gnosis. But this was, of course, not the end of Jung's journey. It went on. It developed. I should add one other thing. Philemon, in Jung's vision, had a wife. Her name was Baucis. Simon Magus, the ancient founder of Gnosticism, had a wife too. Her name was Helen. And Simon had found her, Simon the prophet, Simon the magician, as he was called, had found her in a brothel in Tyre and rescued her because he saw in her the incarnation of Sophianic wisdom. The prophet had a bride. And that bride was the Lady of Wisdom, was Sophia. Okay. The Age of Aquarius. I tried to briefly summarize some of Jung's observations about his Odyssey in the Red Book. I suppose I could have made many lists, but this is the one that came quickly, and it's the one I have in front of me right now. First observation, first summary one might make about what had happened to Jung. Man, humans, live in two worlds. The inner realm is no less real, no less infinite than the outer. But in accord with the spirit of this time, we only look outward, into time and space. We're blinded by the fires of the cosmos, the outer cosmos. To become aware of the inner, timeless, unconscious realm, we must give it our attention. We must turn to the depths, open ourselves to the spirit of the depths, to the light of an inner sun. Vision, imagination, and dream are doorways to that inner world. And Jung found the royal passage of vision, and he did pass through. Second, the inner infinite is the realm of numinous powers. Direct experience of this realm has a soulful savor of divinity, both bright and dark. From time immemorial, humans have accessed such experience, and they have associated it with the mystery of the gods. Only when met experientially is it known. It's not a concept, an object of belief, but
but a fact of human perceptive experience. Next. Confronting this realm of consciousness, our perceived personhood finds itself utterly deposed. It discovers it's not the ruler of its own kingdom or the master of its house, but a humble servant, or perhaps even a serf in thraldom. And this is a shattering experience. However, if one survives the experience, which is a dicey proposition, if one survives the experience, it leads to a vast expansion of consciousness and a new perspective on the nature of life and of self. In sum, we finally know what it is to be human. Next. As experienced and discriminated, the inner world has dualistic qualities, qualities both light and dark, good and evil. A demonic evil dwells there, in us. And there too we meet supernal light. It is heaven and it is hell in there. And this is a great paradox. Consciousness confronts a duality. One realm is reached by ascent, with the help of a dove-like power that ascends to the heights of great light. The other realm requires the aid of a serpent power that probes the deepest instinctual and thonic sources. This is the act of redemption. Hell and heaven are wed in this expansion of consciousness. And I know those are obscure words. Only personal experience can grant them any meaning, as Jung well knew. And lastly, and this is the key, human history is the story of interaction with this wellspring of all consciousness. Human history is the story of the interaction with this wellspring of all consciousness. Our great myths and God stories are reflections of encounters with experiences of profound otherness. This fact of human experience stands apart from metaphysical speculations or conceptualizations. It is the first fire at the forge, the first forming fact. All theologies, all metaphysical statements are secondary constructs. Mere speculations about the sparks scattering from the forge of such primal experience. This is not a theory about human psychological pathology. It's an encompassing confrontation with the mystery of consciousness. I firmly believe that in coming generations, Jung will be met by a much broader range of interest than a focused psychological or psychotherapeutic interest. The man is talking about what it is to be human. Now look, if you're working with your own problems, you're dealing with what it is to be human. The sorrows, the pains, the demons that possess us, the bright angels of our better nature. And if you're a therapist, you're in relationship with those very same forces, dealing with what it is to be human. Concepts will never hold that. Theories will never describe it. Only life knows it. Your life. My life. And to understand what it is to be human, we must understand that humanity hangs on a cross of two realities, two poles,
one characterized by space and time, and another that is imaginal and timeless. The nail at the center of that cross is us, our consciousness. These two facts, time and timeless, history and story, imaginal and physical, these two facts meet in woman and man and in the deepest mystery of what it is to be human, the mystery of life. This is a complete rejection of the monistic scientific materialism of the past two centuries, that great demiurge that rules communal opinion in guise of the spirit of this time. But Jung was not claiming to have made a new discovery. Quite the contrary. He was directing us back into the human story to see the abundant evidence of just this fact. The recurrent evidence of human experience that supports and amplifies a viewpoint which he could otherwise only support by the fact of his own singular experience. His views are empirically derived based on observations made on his own odyssey. But they are supported by the records of others, across time all the way back to the time of Philemon and Simon Magus and Basilides. Jung was really talking about the evolution of human consciousness. My friend, actually, Stefan, who has many more jokes than I ever would. In fact, Stefan used to listen to evangelical ministers who told good jokes, just so he could write down the jokes and use them in his own lectures and sermons. He's got 1,000 jokes. But he tells the metaphor of the bug in the rug, of the moth larvae in the great Persian rug, and the larvae is sitting there, you know, and he's chomping away, and he says, my, the world is blue. And the other larvae, you know, 6 inches away, is sitting there chomping away, saying, my, the world is red. Another larvae, my, the world is yellow. Oh no, now it's red. Each of these little conscious sparks living in its own sub-world of relationship to the colors of the fiber of the rug. And then one day, a larvae molts and flies up into the sky and looks down and, oh my God, it wasn't red, it wasn't blue, it was a pattern, an amazing pattern of things. Much more than ever suspected. But once that little moth is fluttering up on the ceiling, it's very difficult to convey what it has seen to the bugs in the red, blue, green, chartreuse, violet rug. And that is how most humans live. And, you know, look, if you're stuck in the blue, you want to see a therapist to get you out. And if you got far too much red, you need a little anger control, and perhaps you need, you know, to deal with a little bit of green. And sometimes that's all we need to do, really, is shuttle bugs into a better field of fibers to chomp on. But Jung saw a pattern. A pattern. And it's very hard to convey unless you've seen it. Human consciousness of the two worlds has a story. And this story has several chapters. A tale that's not told in years, but it's told in the millennial movement of the heavens above. From the beginning of recorded human history, begun perhaps over 6,000 years ago, Jung saw that there had been three great epochs that had passed, each marked by a constellation of the zodiac. And, my friends, we are now at the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And of course, Jung didn't make this story up. He simply heard it. He heard it in the culture around him. And he understood it. Understood it at a higher level of perspective. Humanity has collectively dreamed its own story and projected it upon the slowly swirling stars. Time has been given a story by human consciousness. Story has a time. Jung saw it. On the first folio page of Liber Novus, projected here on the screen, Jung announces the way of what is to come. Der Weg des Kommenden. It is the revelation of Liber Novus. The revelation he was unsure he was permitted to disclose. And it remained his secret knowledge for 35 years. Only finally at age 75 did he feel that he was given permission to speak it. And when he did speak it, in the last decade of his life, he felt that no one had understood. And he was deeply depressed in those last years, and he felt that he had failed. So you have that long paper I gave you on Jung and Ion. Let me just tell you a little bit about that picture. I got my copy of the Red Book right at the time of publication in October of 2009. And I had already scheduled a series of lectures in my hubris on the Red Book to be given here at Westminster College starting in January. So I had 2.5 months to read and understand the Red Book and prepare a series of lectures. But I was going to read it anyway, believe me. I was reading it. I was there for those months. That's what I was doing. And I thought I understood it. And I'll tell you, I thought I understood it for a reason. Because it wasn't foreign to me. I had understood this visionary quality in Jung from the very beginning, from the seven sermons. I had an idea what he had done. And I had filled in a lot of the blanks on that map, imaginatively from the collected works. Because there were lots of hints in there. Once you see it, once you see the key, you can fill in places, maybe not with great precision, but close enough. I'll tell you, there's one thing that in that initial reading that I missed and that I got this time in this reading, completely, utterly this time. There's one thing that I'd missed actually at the very beginning of this encounter I had with Jung in the seven sermons. I knew there had been visions, and I had a pretty good idea of where they had directed his thoughts and writings in life. I had no perception of how deep into darkness he had gone. I had not understood his journey to hell. I had not known that. And I don't think anyone possibly could have, because he did not reveal that. And the first time I read the Red Book, because I had not seen that in advance, I'd not understood that depth, I read over those sections without really encountering them. Because I thought I knew what I was looking for. In fact, I didn't know. I knew I was looking for many things. I knew what I expected in certain places there based upon the puzzle I had formed out. That piece I had not expected, and I glanced right over it. This time, I had to meet that. And it's been a profoundly, I would say enlightening, but how is... But it was light in darkness. Light in darkness, okay? The light in the darkness. And the darkness did not comprehend it. When I first did this lecture lectures on the Red Book, I didn't look at the pictures. Because Sonu Shamdasani in his introduction suggested that really Jung started with the text. You'd better start with the text. The pictures were a secondary or a third level of exegesis upon the Red Book material. So of course I flipped through it, heavens, how could you avoid doing that? But I had not really spent so much time with it. And then after I'd done that first series of lectures in the spring, I left the Red Book alone. I was full up to here with Red Book. in June, I started looking at it again. And I flipped to that page, that first page, just glancing at it. And then I saw something which I believe Sonu certainly must have seen, but I don't think anyone else had really quite noticed. The way of what is to come. If you look at the first title page, you see that great illuminated D of der Weg, the way. You'll see here two fish swimming in opposite directions. The primal fire of creation is down below, up through the waters of creation, the two fish. Here there's a pot. If you look at the pot, on the pot, there's a little phallus symbol right there. And then ascending from the fire, a serpent, a crowned serpent, ascending. And then, as Jung says in the Red Book, and if you raise your eyes, you will see in the far off distance the forest and the mountains, and above them the stars. And I looked up there. Yes, there's a blue belt up there. It's the zodiacal belt. As you know, the sun and the moon and the planets move through a fixed set of space in the sky. And within that fixed band in which the planets move, humans have told a story. I mean, look, it's just cosmic light, right? It's random. It's chaos. But humans have seen points of light, and they divided it up into 12 sections, 12 sections of differing sizes, and they've seen stars in each of those sections. They've given them names, qualities, powers. It's called the zodiac, the zodiacal houses, right? And the zodiac passes across the night sky. I don't know if any of you look up and see it. I don't know if anyone does anymore with all the light pollution. But if you look up there, you see those constellations, and you see them moving. And the constellations have very ancient symbols that have been used. This is that image from the top of the Red Book. This is the zodiacal belt. These are the symbols of the zodiac. Do you know them? Some of you do. That one's Aquarius. This is Pisces, the two fish. This is Aries, the ram. Taurus, the bull. Gemini.
The twins.
There's something wrong, folks. They're backwards. That's not how they go. If you look up at the heavens, that's not how they go. They are mirror-imaged. They are precessed, put backwards. And where is the sun? The sun is passing through this zodiacal belt, and it is on the cusp between Pisces and Aquarius. And one elongated ray of the sun is stretching out over Aquarius and is touching the words, the way of what is to come. Precessed equinoxes, age of Aquarius. What does that mean? Now, Jung, this was the first page of the Red Book. This is the first thing Jung put down of this entire experience, this most important experience in his life. There was no page of the Red Book, none, that he more thoroughly considered than its first. And on that first page, with his first words and first image, and you'll remember, on that first folio sheet, he says, I speak in images. Only with images can I convey the message, this message it received. Precession of the equinoxes, age of Aquarius. What does that mean? Let me try to explain. First of all, Jung was interested in astrology. And second, I have to confess to you, I have never really been interested in astrology. I grew up in the age of Aquarius. I was a teenager when people were asking you what your sign was. And, you know, my answer was stop. But Jung had been looking into this material earlier on. In fact, he wrote Freud, so I can find it here. This is in 1911. He wrote Freud and says, my evenings are taken up very largely with astrology. I make horoscopic calculations in order to find a clue to the core of psychological truth. I dare say that we shall one day discover in astrology a good deal of knowledge that has been intuitively projected into the heavens. We will find in astrology a good deal of material that has been intuitively projected into the heavens. You understand what he's saying there? I mean, there's nothing up there really, right? It's like walking on that dark road in Wales when everything's dark, really dark, completely and utterly dark. The only thing you see is what's in you. You see it, but ditto, you look at the stars, it's chaos. If you're seeing patterns up there, it's because you are telling your story there. Well, humans, for 6,000 years, have been telling their story there. And there are people in this room, I suspect, who have turned to a page on the internet or in an old-fashioned newspaper to read their horoscope for today. And I suspect every single one of you knows what sign you are. Hmm? Yeah. Damn hippies. So, and then he said in another letter, I have the feeling that this is a time full of marvels. This is again in 1911, and he again wrote this to Freud. I have the feeling that this is a time full of marvels. And if the auguries do not deceive us, it may very well be that we are on the threshold of something really sensational, which I scarcely know how to describe except with the Gnostic concept of Sophia. Sophia means wisdom. An Alexandrian term particularly suited to the reincarnation of ancient wisdom in the shape of psychoanalysis. Carl Gustav Jung, 1911. Jung had paid attention to astrology well before the Red Book period. And there is a concept of a new age. This actually was discovered by a Greek astronomer by the name of Hipparchus around 140, 150 BC. Hipparchus, looking at the records of prior Greek stargazers and comparing his own precise visualizations of the position of the heavens, had noticed something quite revolutionary. The position of the zodiac was shifting. The sun is in a house of the zodiac, right? It transits through the houses of the zodiac by the seasons. At the spring equinox, known as the spring point, or the equinoctial point, the moment when day and night are equal, the sun is in, or had been seen to be, in the house at the beginning of the constellation of Pisces. What Hipparchus noted in 150 BC is that based on his calculations, at the moment of the equinox, the sun had shifted its position. Ancient Greek astronomers had seen it and noted its position. And he, with his fine precision, after hundreds of years, could say that it had moved. The heavens were moving. The fixed, immovable Empyrean realm was moving. And it was moving backwards. And Hipparchus could then calculate, based upon the variation he had seen over 300 or 400 years of Greek astronomical observations. And believe me, this is amazing science, if you think about it. Amazing observational ability. That over 2,000 years, the sun moves backwards one zodiacal house at the spring equinox. At the spring equinox, in 140, Hipparchus looked up, and the sun was just entering Pisces. He could say that 2,000 years previously, at that moment, the sun had been in the house, not of Pisces, but the preceding equinoctial point of Aries. And he could predict that in about 2,000 or 2,600 years or 2,400 years, that it would shift again. It would shift into the house, the age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius. Now, why did that happen? Well, I could explain it to you. the axis of, that the Earth rotates upon, that skewer running from north and south, it actually has a wobble. It's just like a top spinning very quickly on a table going round, round, round. The axis of the top may shift a little bit and usually shifts sort of in a regular circle. It's just how physics work. The Earth does the same thing. And over 26,000 years, the Earth's axis actually shifts as it turns, where it is relative to the fixed stars around. So the zodiacal belt is changing, and it's moving backwards, precession. Precession of the equinoxes. Well, now look, this was a mind blower, because the heavens are supposed to be fixed, and they're not supposed to move, and now they're moving. But this was not really made part of the mythological matrix of the ancient world. Nonetheless, amazingly, the symbol of the fish did slowly become incorporated into the image of the Christian myth. The fish became an image of the Christian. It's very unlikely that when this happened, at least so Jung supposed, anyone really was thinking much about this precession of the equinoxes. This was Greek science. It was the motions, the amount of movement of the axis was minuscule over a year or even 100 years. There may have been only one cult in the ancient world who took notice of Hipparchus's discovery of the precessional factor of the equinox, that even the fixed stars were moving, and that was probably the Mithraic cult. This is based on a book written by a fellow by the name of David Ulansey, published 20 or so years ago. And I should also add that one of Jung's first interests was in the Mithraic liturgy, of a mystical initiation text that he had encountered. So, Age of Aquarius, where did that idea come from? Somehow, in the last few hundred years, the fact that the position the sun will be in, the house it will be in at the spring point, is moving into the Age of Aquarius, was taken note of in occult circles. It was talked about well before Jung's time. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society in the 1880s, said, early 1880s, said something along the lines of that soon we will be entering a new age, and at that time the psychologists will have their hands full of strange symptoms. Jung saw a new age was beginning, and he put that message on the first page of Liber Novus. We were entering a new age, an age of Aquarius. Throughout the Red Book, once you know this, once you see this signal image, you'll see that he's talking about that throughout Liber Novus. For example, he says, and he actually says this in the conversations around the Philemon, when the month of the twins had ended, and when did the month of twins end? The month of the twins of Gemini, this would have been about 2500 BC, about the time of the beginning of the Old Kingdom in Egypt, one of the beginning points of history. So Jung is saying, and this is what he says in Liber Novus, he says, when the month of the twins had ended, the men said to their shadows, you are I, since they had previously had their spirit around them as a second person. What's he saying? That there had been this mystical primitiveness, that the spiritual forces were out and around. Something that we still might find in primitive or Stone Age or Aboriginal or normal modern people who see the light of, in the darkness. This was a movement in consciousness. And that realm was brought inward. Thus the two became one, Jung continues. And through this collision, the formidable broke out. Precisely that spring of consciousness that one calls culture, and which lasted until the time of Christ. In the time of Christ, that was the end of Aries and the beginning of the age of Pisces. But the fish, Pisces, the fish indicate the moment when what was united split, according to the eternal law of contrasts, into an underworld and upper world. If the power of growth begins to cease, then the united falls into its opposites. But the separated cannot remain separated forever. It will be united again, and the month of the fish will soon be over. Jung is saying that there is a story that human beings have projected into the heavens themselves, a story that they have had within themselves and over thousands of years have been telling about what it is to be human. He sensed that throughout the ages, an occasional wayfarer had found this great Janus Gate, the dual-visaged passage in the wall between home and beyond, and there had witnessed story and history, spinning destiny. You can call them prophets or bards or wizards or lunatics, or wayfaring men. Jung was one. What was Jung's criticism of the Christian age? Have any of you got that image out of this? He said in that passage I just read, "But the fish indicate the moment when what was united split according to the eternal laws of contrast." This is a complex issue within the Red Book, and it has to do a lot with Jung's critique of modern religion and of Christianity itself. Jung felt that in the Christian movement, Christ and Satan had been clearly distinguished as two separate forces. One had been placed in heaven, one had been placed in hell. Dualities had been discriminated. And we were expected to be Christ-like and deny our Satan-like qualities. We were to rise to the light and deny the dark. But even Christ, so saw Jung, had to descend into the darkness and meet it. Jung felt that in this discrimination of the opposites, there had been a division of human consciousness. In the first 1,000 years of this age of Pisces, now coming to an end, the human spirit had soared up into the heights, manifest perhaps in the soaring spires of the Gothic cathedrals in the 11th century. And then an antiodromy had come, a twist. The Antichrist had come to the stage, human creative consciousness, and had turned to the earth, to discovery, to technology, to creation of its own world. And at this point, certainly in the secular culture of Western Europe, Christianity has been deposed. It is a secular, materialistic world. We are in the grips of that world. The opposites, heaven and earth. Jung felt strongly, and he says this repeatedly, that we must understand that heaven and hell are within us. There has to be a reunification of this understanding, this discrimination of consciousness. Not to say that we're embracing darkness, but in darkness there is light. In us there is darkness. In us there is that light. And so he finished that passage saying, "The separated cannot remain separated forever. It will be united again, and the month of the fish will soon be over." However you define it, however you try to understand it, the man had seen something in those visions. He had seen that we are at the turning point. The turning point that only comes once every few thousand, 2,000 or more years. Jung saw that in the age of Aquarius, there would be a new type of human consciousness. We would come to understand that gods and demons are experiences of ourselves. They are in us. That's not to trivialize them. That's not to speak of them as our possession, but it's to speak of them as things accessible to our conscious perception, realities within our conscious perception, within us, that in this motion of consciousness, a new age of humanity would be born. And the man saw his duty at this critical moment was to help harbor in awareness, help usher in awareness of what was upon us, of the task that awaited us, that he stood at a doorway. He was helping open a door to a new ion, a new age, a new epoch of human consciousness. Quite a task. Liber Novus, the new book, is a new book for a new age, a new ion. But Jung did not know if he could speak it. In 1916, Jung did not know if he could ever say what he had seen. I've talked about what happened after the Red Book period. From 1920 to 1930, Jung was finishing his work on the Red Book. He had started building his tower. And then he saw the Secret of the Golden Flower sent to him by Richard Wilhelm. He saw that there was a way of talking about what had happened to him without revealing his experience. Sonu calls this Jung's effort at the comparative study of the individuation process. In other words, looking historically for visionary experience similar to what Jung had had, and then using this to explain the experience of the inner world. Sonu, Dr. Shamdasani, calls this the comparative study of the individuation process, and I do not like that term. I don't think that's a very good phrase because hardly anyone knows what the hell the individuation process is. It obscures what Jung was doing. What Jung was doing is looking at human history for the history of vision, for the hermeneutic, for the interpretive effort spent by human beings in bringing form to their visions. And he felt by the 1940s that he had gone astray. He felt that he had not gotten where he needed to go. But then something happened in 1944 that completely changed his perspective. In 1944, he took a walk in February, and he slipped in the snow, and he fractured his ankle, his fibula. It was a minor injury. And in Jungian, if you read the biographies, everyone says, and then he had a heart attack. Well, folks, I'm an ER doctor. He didn't have a heart attack. He had a pulmonary embolus. What happened is he went to a young doctor, and they put a cast that was a bit too tight on his broken ankle. No big deal. But then what happened? He got a blood clot in his leg. And 12 days later, exactly when it happens, he had an embolism. Not a heart attack. He had a pulmonary embolus. Not that this matters to any of you, but it matters to me. Got to make the diagnosis, right? And it's pretty clear if you read the documentation, this is what happened to the man. Now, a pulmonary embolus is a blood clot. It goes up into the heart. It can be as big as your thumb if it comes out of a leg vessel. And it plugs up the vessels going from your heart into your lungs. And Jung's embolus was huge. And he nearly died. For 3 weeks, the man hung between life and death. And I should also add that in 1944, there was no effective treatment for a pulmonary embolism except waiting to see if people lived or died. And he laid in bed, and for three weeks, he had amazing visions. Amazing visions. He told the story of these visions. Let me see if I can find it here in my notes. He told the story to a woman by the name of Margaret Ostrowski Sachs. And this is in a very obscure document. It's very hard to find. Let me just read you what he told her very late in life. He said, "The fracture of my fibula was highly symbolic to me. I asked myself for some time where my fault lay. After a while, I found out. I had trespassed into foreign country. It is as if one were walking in one's garden after dark and had fallen into a hole. Ignorance also acts in the same way as guilt,
so that although one is not always aware of straying into a strange land, it can happen and lead to inflation. And then he goes on saying what his fault had been. And at this time he'd been writing the book, which is known now as Psychology of the Transference. It's about, really about his relationship to Tony Wolfe, about what happened in the Red Book period. He said, I had written about anima and animus, believing I was working with psychology, but I had transgressed into God's country. Alchemy had seemed to me to be a legitimate branch of science, but its contents, anima, animus, the self, and the alchemical marriage, are not simply scientific concepts. They are gods. I had not been aware of this, not through presumption, but through naive stupidity. And then he broke his leg, he nearly died, and he talks about the visions. He said, I had the most wonderful visions, like an invisible theater from a seat high up in a wide valley. I experienced there everything I described in my book Ion. I did not actually see it all, but knew it. Christian alchemy, the union of Tifereth and Malkuth, the marriage of the Lamb. I also had my questions answered. I had my questions answered, not in words, yet all was revealed, everything correct, everything meaningful and complete. This continued for 3 weeks. It was as if free of my body. And I had the feeling of floating in space, as quiet as the center of the universe. Nothing was missing. Everything was there. It was like the peace of the Father. I was ages old. Before my illness, I had often asked myself if I were permitted to publish or even speak my secret knowledge. Before my illness, I often asked myself if I were permitted to publish or even speak my secret knowledge. I later set it all down in Ion. I realized it was my duty to communicate these thoughts. Yet I doubted whether it was allowed to give expression to them. During my illness, I received confirmation, and I now knew that everything had meaning and that everything was perfect. The third age of human history, vastly played out over two past millennia, is drawing to a close. We now stand at the threshold of a new age, an epical turning of perspective, and an antiodromia in human consciousness is coming. The demiurgic spirit of this time, with its dominant monistic rationalism, has reached a cataclysmic end time. And my friends, this is a period of darkness. It is a period of dissolution. And it is a period of immense psychic disruption. And it's only beginning. That age of Aquarius, astrologically, really does not start until about the year 2600. By earliest calculations, we're just at the cusp of the beginning of that age. Transitions of this sort are slow things. Things not of a generation, but generations and centuries. And right now we face great danger, great disruption. Jung wrote in a letter in 1955, he said, transitions between the aeons always seem to have been melancholy and despairing times. As, for instance, the collapse of the Old Kingdom in Egypt between Taurus and Aries. Or the melancholy of the Augustinian age between Aries and Pisces. And now we are moving into Aquarius. And we are only at the beginning of this apocalyptic development. Already, I am a great-grandfather twice over, and see those distant generations growing up, who long after we are gone will spend their lives in that darkness. Not very happy words. Not very happy.
But I've seen it. I have seen it. I must say it is so. But there will be a dawn. As the old age fragments and fractures, deep seams are rent open, and from the forgotten depths, an ageless treasure will emerge. It will. In coming times, humankind will rediscover the manifold essence of an inner world, a world light and dark. And with it will come a new perception of what it is to be human. In visions noted in his Black Book Journal during the spring of 1916, Christ twice appeared. On April 12th, he came vested in his robe of glory. The vision is recorded in the last pages of Liber Novus. Philemon is given the voice and addresses Christ. He addresses him, "My master, my brother, praise be your name. But, my master, my brother, I believe you have completed your work. Since the one who has given his life, his entire truth, all his love, his entire soul, has completed his work. What one individual can do for men, you have done and accomplished and fulfilled. The time has come when each must do his own work of redemption. Mankind has grown old, and a new aeon has begun." These words well summarize Jung's myth of the passing and coming age. Christ has completed his work. Now each must do his own. A new month, the fourth age of human consciousness has begun. And Jung's words, "Learn from the suffering of a crucified God." The new aeon signals emergence of a transforming divine image and eventually of a new religion. And Jung had seen it. Very, very near the end of his life, Jung said, "It's good to be old in years because it often looks as if we were arriving at the end of the history of our world. Or at least that it will get terribly dark before the light can shine again and make it possible to see clearly." We face powerful magic, and we face disruption in this age. We face great challenges. Those of you who meet this man, Carl Gustav Jung, and the guiding vision he gives us in Liber Novus, a vision for a new age, you will be a light in that darkness, guides and hope. And a blessing to future generations. The world and the destiny of human consciousness at the beginning of this age hangs by a thread. And that thread is the psyche. It is the soul. It is the fact, the reality of that inner world. It is my hope and my prayer that some of you within listening will have ears to hear that message. Because destiny depends upon your consciousness, your awareness, your awakeness, your humanity in its entirety. The psyche is real, Many people will deny it. They will ignore it. They will fail to meet the call issued from its depths. But you must not. You must not. Because the hope of aeons await. The treasure rests in your depths with your soul. Thank you very much. Well, look, I just want to thank you guys for letting me do this. It's been very, very, very stimulating having such a wonderful group of people to talk to. I mean, I wouldn't have done this. I wouldn't have been thinking about these things as deeply as I have if I hadn't had people that I really wanted so very deeply to communicate with. And I've gotten that back from you. So I really wish to give you my thanks.